You're listening to Sci-Fi for Chicks on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Coming up on a special Thanksgiving episode of Sci-Fi for Chicks, the ladies discuss the female characters they're thankful for in genre.
Joss Whedon had readily admitted that part of the reason Buffy was able to make it as a series was because of the popularity of Xena. And so, you know, we would have never had Buffy had we not had Xena.
It gives a really needed backstory to this character that you just assume is evil and awful and just... oh, she just wants the shoes for power and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, there's always two sides to a coin.
I think that's part of the reason why I enjoyed Peggy Carter as much as I did, because she fought like a girl, quote unquote.
She was trying to find different ways to be a strong female, not just strong and kick butt.
Ripley was originally written as a man, and when they ended up casting Sigourney Weaver, they didn't do anything other than change the pronouns. I mean, that says so much.
That's next on Sci-Fi for Chicks, Women of Genre. Do you ever wonder what a woman really thinks about?
Doctor Who.
Harry Potter.
Lust.
Orphan Black.
Grimm.
Space.
The Final Fear of the Frontier. Walking Dead.
Outlander.
Star Wars.
Heroes and Heroes Reborn.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agent Carter.
Mr. Robot.
Lord of the Rings.
I, Zombie.
Stargate.
Aliens.
The Secrets of the Immortal Nicholas
The Marvel Film. Movie.
Penny Dreadful.
Walking Dead.
X-Men.
Cosmos.
Firefly.
Game of Thrones.
Harry Dresden.
The Return.
The Spiderwick Chronicles.
Teen Wolf.
Sherlock.
Battlestar Galactica.
Sleepy
Hollow.
Star Trek.
Torchwood.
Guardian of the Galaxy.
All you have to do is listen. This is Sci-Fi for Chicks.
Thanks for tuning in to Sci-Fi for Chicks, Women of Genre, a look at the female characters in some of our favorite movies, TV shows, books, and more. My name is Heather French. I'll be your host for this episode. And instead of us talking about one project and the female characters in that, we're going to do a little differently. We're going to have a Thanksgiving episode and talk about the female characters, at least some of the female characters, that we are most thankful for out there in genre. Joining me today, we have Marie Lim, aka Vera Cosplay. Hey, Marie.
Hi.
It's nice to have you back. I haven't podcasted with you in a while.
It's nice to be back.
And joining us, not new to podcasting and definitely not new to sci-fi4me.com, but first time on Sci-Fi for Chicks, we have Angie Fiedler-Sutton. Hey, Angie.
Hey, welcome. Thanks.
It's good to have you aboard. You've got some great articles that I've seen you writing out there, and you throw out a lot of things, and you're busy. So it's good to get you to squeeze in and join the chicks here.
Yes, I finally have stopped working nights, so now I can, weekends are fine.
Well, we will get you on many more in the future, I'm sure. Before we get started, I want to say one more thanks, and that is to our listeners out there. We really do appreciate you taking the time and your schedule to listen to Sci-Fi for Chicks, both the Women of Genre and our TV show recap podcast. We do iZombie, and Maya and Cammie have just started Grimm. If you are not subscribed to us already, we would love for you to go over to iTunes or the podcast platform of your choice and subscribe. Just search for Sci-Fi for Chicks. We'd also love to hear what you think about past episodes, any new topics that you would like for us to talk about in the future, some of your favorite sci-fi fantasy, or maybe you want to actually just join in on a podcast. You can let us know by emailing us sci-fi4chicks@sci-fi4me.com. You can, of course, go over to Twitter and let us know. Just follow us at sci-fi4chicks. And of course, there's our hotline, 573-427-2434. That's 573-42-SCI-FI, because we would really love to get more women on here and get some more opinions. I'm really glad to have both Marie and Angie here to shake it up a little bit here. And have a little bit more fun with some of the different women out there. Get some different perspectives, because already just a little bit I've talked to you, Angie, you've already talked about some ones that I'm not as familiar with because I wasn't a big reader as a child. And I already know Marie. I know she's going to have some good ones here too. So let's just go ahead and dive in and start our Thanksgiving episode with some of the women, the female characters that we are thankful for in genre. Angie, why don't you start us off?
Well, yeah, like as you said, I was very much a reader growing up, and because, you know, I'm probably a little bit older than you, and so this was before the lovely intervention of the internet, and so it was either books or, you know, the three channels I had on TV. But yeah, I was very bookish and very much a nerd growing up, and so Lucy in the Chronicles of Narnia books, especially the first two, and then Ailanwy very quickly over in the Prydain Chronicles, which were by Lloyd Alexander, were very much two of the main girls that kind of were my first female character introductions, followed very quickly by Meg in the Madeline L'Engle Wrinkle in Time books. But all three of them were, you know, very, you know, somewhat loosely based on the tropes that you normally see in these kind of fantasy novels. But at the same time, Lucy especially was very much geared towards like Alice and Alice in Wonderland. But they all, you know, kind of took on their own plot and they all took on their own story. And they all, Ailanwy especially was very much the tomboy girl, which was, that was the really first time in my life that I had seen that as a character type. Before then, all the girls that I had come across were your stereotypical, you know, princesses that needed to be rescued. And she rescued herself. She was just like, you know what? I don't need you. I am not, you know, here for you to be rescued. And she kicked a lot of butt, and that was not something I had seen before. And that was, she made a very big impact on me as a result. I mean, to this day, I have a letter that I had written. I'd written Lloyd Alexander a thank you letter because my fiction writing style is very, very much based off of his. I've realized that. And I wrote him a letter of that, and he had written me back before he passed. Oh, cool. And to this day, that's one of the reasons I'm still fascinated by, well, you know, it's based on Welsh legends. I don't know how familiar you are with the Prydain Chronicles. But that's part of the reason why I'm still very, very fascinated by the Welsh and the Irish heritage, because, I mean, it's just steeped in that kind of world. And much more it's much more realistic fantasy based versus the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, which is very much fantasy based.
Right. Oh, definitely. That's interesting that you bring up getting more interested. It made you more interested in like the whole Welsh writing and myths and legend things, because I think that's what those books really, I used to work in kids' books. So I recommended these books that you're talking about quite a lot, even based on recommendations from people like you who had read them. And I was very good at pretending that I had read them too. But I think that was one of the, it's true. Don't believe everything your bookseller tells you about what they've read. But I think that's one of the things I liked when I would hear people talk about it, was that it was something that did kind of open you up to something more. It wasn't just this one little story. You did kind of become interested more in where it came from and how it related to that culture and such.
Well, and I'm still anxiously waiting. I'm assuming Disney still has the rights to the series, because they did a very, very bad version of The Black Cauldron, which was the second book in the Prydain books. This was back in the dark era of Disney. And I'm assuming they still have the rights to the story. I'm waiting for them to realize that now that fantasy has kind of come back into its own and everybody's now doing fantasy series that are more than one book, and them going, hey, we could do a live action version of these.
Well, I think with some of the technology we have now, it can make it more believable where it doesn't have to be just animated to be able to get some of that stuff across.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it specifically about some of these characters, like you said, that they weren't saving themselves? What really spoke to you? And was it your age, their age? Was it something you were aspiring to be more like?
I'm sure with all three of those, it was because they were the same age as me. They were all around about 12, 13. And you know, when I first introduced them, which is probably when I first came across them. But they were all, you know, curious, which was something I did. Meg from the Wrinkle in Time, she was very bookish. She read constantly herself. She was very much the stereotypical nerd, which is what I was. Yes, and still are. Ailanwy, like I said, she was very much a tomboy. I have two older brothers, so of course I grew up not wanting to be very much a girly girl. And very much wanting to kind of be my own person. And that's kind of, I guess, all three of them had different reasons why I connected to them. And for Ailanwy specifically, I think it was just because, like I said, she very much was, you know, I don't need you to rescue me. I can rescue myself. But mm-hmm. she was also very much willing to admit that everybody needs help. So it was that very, very thin line between being, you know, the stereotype of the tomboy, but also being willing to acknowledge that there are others in the world that you know, everybody needs somebody in their life kind of thing. And so right. She was always, you know, she was the quote unquote fiery redhead. and that he definitely played up that trope in the writing, but you know, that she readily acknowledged it a couple of times too. Yeah, she was just very much her own woman. And as the series grew, and as they started to kind of turn it into the romance between her and the main character, she never lost that. She never, you know, succeeded, you know, never bowed to him and said, you know, you're the man, you know best. She was very much, even to the very end book, was constantly, you know, arguing with him and debating with him and saying, you know, my thoughts are just as viable as yours.
Now, what kind of age growth do we have here? You said they were like maybe started 12, 13-ish. How old do you think they got?
I probably, considering it's, you know, based on Welsh legend, which meant they died, you know, 30. probably till their late early 20s, probably is where the last book, because the last, I mean, not to spoil the series, but they have been out for a while. The last book, they, you know, Taran, the head, the main character, he basically fights to become and ends up becoming king. He ends up being the High King of the High King, which is the last book in the series. And so, you know, old enough to know what he wants to do with his life. And they actually, there is a book where he basically kind of goes through that college year of what do I do with my life kind of thing. Of course, since this is a fantasy book, it's all in pursuit of that he realizes he's in love with Ailanwy and he needs to prove himself to her.
That's interesting, talking about the growth over a series of books and not just having to keep it in one. So I'm sure that probably helped also with that, the character development, especially with the women being able to allow them to grow over many, as opposed to just beginning, middle, end of one book.
Mm-hmm.
Are these anything that you read, Marie? I mean, these are one, like I said, I recommended these to a lot of kids in my bookstore days.
No, but I know what she's talking about, getting interested in the legends of a culture. For me, it was the Percy Jackson books, and so I got really into Greek, like, Greek mythology and stuff because of those books.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand where that's coming from, reading a series and being like, oh, this thing is so cool.
Interestingly, like I said, I wasn't much of a reader when I was a kid, but Angie, you kind of brought up one of the women that I, well, I hate to say women because she was definitely a girl, the girl of genre that I'm actually really thankful for. I was not a reader, as I said. My whole family were full of readers, and my dad could do War and Peace on Christmas morning and need something by the afternoon. And I wasn't that fast. So I kind of went the other way to TV and film. But there was this TV show, and this is where I'm going to go, thank you, Angie, for thinking that I'm so much younger than you. Mwah, love you. But there was a TV show that we watched actually in school. I think it was before they had, you know, like those teacher days when no kids came in. So it was the time the teacher could catch up and everything. And I remember this guy with a big bushy mustache, and he would talk about the book, and then he would draw a scene from the book as they acted out. You know, you heard them read a passage from it. And there was this one book called The Faraway Lures by Harry Benn, which is a 1960s book. It's now way out of print. And it intrigued me not just because of this mythology, but also I have to say the first thing that got me was the lead character's name was Heather. And there were no other Heathers around at that time. I mean, really, no other Heathers when I was a kid. So that got me interested that the heroine of this book was Heather. And it came from a story he had heard from his mother's culture in Denmark of this farmer plowing the field and coming across an old cedar coffin. And when they called up the archaeologist, they opened it up and there's all these artifacts and things here, but the acids from the tree had actually dissolved all of her bones, but they could still see the outline of the girl and see that she was this beautiful young girl with this blonde hair. And then there was like a box of burned bones of like a 10 or 12 year old child next to her, and this crude metal, I think it was a like a belt buckle kind of an amulet, but it was very crude. But she was obviously a Stone Age girl. And he created this story around this actual piece of, you know, well, it's archaeological relic here. And Heather was the tree people daughter, She was the daughter of the chief of the tree people who were the Stone Age, and they worshipped the streams and the trees and all that nature. And they run across this tribe of the Sun people who were more Bronze Age. And of course, we had our Romeo and Juliet thing with Wolfstone, the chief's son, and the whole intermixing with them. But I think why I really like that, even though I didn't read that much as a child, that this is one I read, was because, just like you said, she wasn't this one that needed rescuing. She wasn't ditching her culture. She wasn't saying, oh, my parents know nothing and I don't like how backwards my people are. She wasn't totally going over to the Sun people. She wasn't thinking they were just evil, that because they were different than her. She was really trying to explore and find out more. And even when she was scared, she would try to persevere through. And she was trying to rationalize things out. You know, how can I love my family, but I also love this new person and they're so diametrically opposed? And she was really trying to work things out and figure out the best way to move forward. And it didn't work out in many cases, but I like the fact that she made her own decisions, but still stay very respectful of where she was from and the people she loved and the other people's culture. And so she was just a really strong character. To this day, it's one of my favorite books. I actually, the only screenplay that, or the only book I've ever adapted into a screenplay that was actually, I was quite impressed with. So, because she made that big of an impression on me. And it's, like I said, it's out of print, but it's a fun young reader's book. It's definitely young readers. Don't read it like an adult.
Well, I had to already, but since we're talking about books and stuff, I've been listening to the audiobook of Wicked. Oh. And I think it's worth mentioning Elphaba.
Oh, that's a good one.
Because she's such an anti-hero, or she's treated like an anti-hero, but she came from this family. Like, I'm reading the book right now, and it's talking about her family and the nanny who took care of her, and her mother, who was this amoral woman who was married to this minister who was also horribly amoral. And just, it's so interesting to see how, despite, like, how she was brought up and how she was treated as a toddler and as a child, and how she was thrown by the wayside, especially when her sister was born. Mm-hmm. But she always stood up for what she thought was right. She always looked out for her sister. And even when it made her the quote-unquote villain, she still, you know, she still fought for what she believed in. And I think that really speaks to me. I think that's really cool.
Oh, I was going to say, she really was trying to stay true to who she was.
Yeah, and that's has to be hard when you're green. I mean,
it's not easy being green. Just make it in Kermit.
Yeah, yeah. But she's definitely someone worth mentioning when it comes to literature. Because everyone knows the Wicked Witch of the West, mm-hmm. but Wicked is such a cool book, and I loved the musical. I adored the musical so much.
Well, and that actually, I'm glad you brought up that you've seen the musical. So, because I've seen the musical, and I've started reading the book, and then just got distracted. So what are the, I know there's a lot of differences.
Do you
see some of the differences?
Quite a bit of differences.
Well, in her character, not, you know, but what do you think they did well going to the musical? What do you think? Talk about the Elphaba in relation to the two.
I've not gone very far in the book. Like I said, I listen to it in the car when I'm going places. I'm pretty sure I'm just now getting to her going to Shiz. But it's, as far as differences between the musical and the book is far less child-friendly. Like, Wicked is a very family-friendly musical, and it's, the book is a lot more raw and honest, and I almost like that more about it, because it kind of gives a really needed backstory to this character that you just assume is evil and awful and just, oh, she just wants the shoes for power and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, there's always two sides to a coin. So I think that's really cool.
Right. Well, Angie, it sounds like you've read and seen.
Yeah. No, I've read the book a while back, and actually, I didn't care for it, not because of the thing, but because I felt it was a little too ambitious on the political statement. It was very much post 9/11 reactionary, I felt. Right. And mm-hmm. so it had a lot of that, and it was very much too much on the nose, I felt. It got a little old for me, but and I have seen the musical too. What I, in terms of the comparison, how I describe it is that the book is very much the true story of the Wicked Witch if you've read the book version of The Wizard of Oz, whereas the musical Wicked is the true story of the Wicked Witch if you've seen the movie version of The Wizard of Oz. And as anyone who's ever read The Wicked Witch, you know, if anyone's ever read Baum's actual Wizard of Oz, you know that it is nothing like the MGM musical. Right. And it's very much the same thing. The musical is very much a and for very good reason. That they knew when, you know, when what's his face, the guy who wrote the music, when he started writing it, I'm sure he was aware that, you know, there's going to be a lot more people aware of the movie than they are of the book. And so right. I'm sure he specifically took in tropes of the movie and went for that. So in terms of characterization, she definitely comes across much more, like you said, much more darker, much more harsh in the book, much more dire than she is in the musical. Not that that's anything bad, because obviously bad stuff happens to everybody, and we all have to have those moments of doing the right thing, even if it's the wrong thing, if that makes sense. And she very much struggles with that much more in the book, because you have much more time to do that. Right. And much more, there's much more conflict with her and her sister in the book than there is in the musical, and much more conflict between her and Glinda.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I remember when this came out, by the books by Philip McGuire, and he did the whole Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister and Son of a Witch that continues on all this, is there really a look at what the Wicked Witch / now Elphaba was like before this, or was it really just all from the Dorothy good side from Baum till McGuire?
It's been a long time since I read The Wizard of Oz. I was a really young kid when I first read it, and so I don't remember there being anything really being written about the witch that wasn't, you know, all in the, she's the villain, she's the antagonist of the story, like. But that's just from what I remember. Like I said, I was like 7.
Yeah, I don't remember anybody else tackling any kind of alternate version of her. So I think that's interesting that we did have this dark character that, you know, we all have. Come on, I to this day have that music, dun, 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 you know, when you think of the Wicked Witch and, you know, coming at you, that the whole I'll get you my pretty and all that, to actually look at that darker side and see that, yes, the dark side is there, but here's not even excuse, or it's just the reason of why some of the things are the way they are. And that just because she's the Wicked Witch doesn't mean she's, just because she's evil doesn't mean she's bad, if that makes sense. I thought that was interesting.
But I know, especially after seeing the musical, I always looked up to her because, oh, that's the ultimate way to be different. Maybe not the ultimate way, but it certainly felt like it for her, I'm sure.
Right.
And when you feel different, it takes a lot to, it takes even more to do things that are against the flow, because you already stand out so much, you just want to fit in, so it takes a lot more courage to stand out.
True.
And I appreciate that, and I want to be more like that.
Does having this side of the Wicked Witch now make you look at the Wicked Witch and Glinda in Wizard of Oz any differently? Like, when you watch it, do you go, huh, Glinda, you're not so wonderful and perfect?
Yes, I do. I always judge Glinda. I'm like, you're not telling the whole story here, girl. Fess up.
Now, how do you compare that to, what was it, the Great and Powerful Oz, the Franco movie
that came out of what?
I don't want to talk about that movie.
Thank you.
That movie killed me.
Yeah, it was.
It killed me, because I was already a fan of Wicked when I went and saw that movie, and I was just sitting there like, oh, this is, I don't know.
They could have done so much better in that.
Yeah. I think they really tainted what could have been what was really growing to be a really great new mythology within this, kind of the splinter mythology from the bomb.
Yeah.
And I didn't appreciate it either. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful film. But it's kind of like, yeah, look at the shiny, pretty object and forget all this other stuff that we're...
Yeah, I think that was the biggest problem. They were far too distracted by, ooh, this is 3D.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's move on to something else. Come on, Angie. Give us something else you're thankful for.
Well, with regards to when Marie said she got into Greek mythology, we can't do a Women We're Thankful For without Xena/Gabby from Xena Warrior Princess. I was already knowledgeable of Greek mythology before those series came on, and I loved the Hercules series because, and I think part of what made that show go bad so badly in the last couple of seasons is they forgot kind of their origins. What made it work, it was that it was so corny and so right in your face. This is not serious. You know, we're obviously going to have, you know, fun with this. And one season we're going to, you know, talk with the Romans, and the next season we're going to, you know, be introduced to Jesus.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And that's what made it work was, and it was when they first started going serious was when the show kind of started going downhill. But considering that that was like one of the very first series that decided to capitulate to fans and make the pairing canon, to make Xena and Gabby canon. Again, spoilers for the last couple of seasons, but they do end up becoming, you know, in a relationship in the last season. And that was unheard of during back that time, you know, to have that kind of LGBT representation on screen. And also because part of, you know, the main reason they did it was because there was such a huge contingent of fans that said, these ladies are not just friends.
What's interesting is that the recent Dallas Comic-Con fan days, we went there and they had the Xena reunion. And we have that up on the site over at scififorme.com. Lucy Lawless and Renee O'Connor just chatting away and having a great time. They didn't get it at first. Mm-hmm. Like the fans were telling them and they're like, what are you talking about? That it was because it was being built, you know, so subtly at the beginning, not so subtly, but it could be taken multiple ways. They actually didn't get it for quite a while, but that's how things were going. And then they're like, oh, okay. But something I think that they did do well with that I think Renee pointed out was that it was subtle enough that if you were watching it with your family, if you're watching it with your kids, it wasn't so completely in your face that you know, that you couldn't enjoy the film, you know, that it wasn't just all about that. That was a part of who they were. It wasn't all that they were.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and back to my whole why I liked a lot, you know, my other ladies, you had the pairing of Xena being your stereotypical kick-ass woman, whereas Gabby was much more of the softer, although she, of course, grew as the series went because, as all sidekicks, she got tired of being the sidekick. But, you know, you had the both types of the stereotypical women you see on screen, and it worked with the two of them, and it was their friendship that ended up being what the series was about. And, you know, all the other stuff, all the craziness, you know, was secondary to the fact of what their relationship, and whether it was romantic or just a normal friendship, that was the core of the series. And that's what made the series work, was because they had this dynamic.
Something they also brought up that I hadn't really even thought of this, because I do remember watching Xena. I would come home from work or something. It was on Saturday afternoons, and it was fun because my aunt, she loved Hercules. She was a big Kevin Sorbo fan. So I saw Hercules, and then Xena was on right after it, and I started watching it because of that. And yeah, you're right. It was like this fun, schlocky camp fest, and it sucked me in. I watched it pretty much every week. Something that Lucy Lawless said was that really was kind of groundbreaking, unfortunately, was she was the first female superhero lead on TV since The Bionic Woman. It was 16 years. And I started thinking, no, that can't be right. Oh, wait, yeah, I can't think of a single TV show where the woman was the lead superhero-ish type, you know, in that whole time.
Well,
and that's sad.
I want to say that I want to remember reading somewhere that Joss Whedon had readily admitted that part of the reason Buffy was able to make it as a series was because of the popularity of Xena. And so, you know, we would have never had Buffy had we not had Xena.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that. I did like her. She was, both her and Gabrielle, I think they did bring something really fun, and they were really pretty much just two sides of the same coin. I think they were actually just one woman that they kind of pulled apart into the two, like you were saying, the more kick-ass side and the softer side. But I liked how they did. I didn't like the ending. And I know there's a huge...
Yeah, no, I didn't either.
Spoilers, but, you know, there's a huge Xena contingent out there that is trying to get NBC, Universal, to do a Xena revival with Lucy Lawless and Renee O'Connor and just totally fix the ending, which Lucy and Renee said they are totally up for. There's a petition out there, if you're with them on that, to let the, you know, try and get NBC to bring that back. But so who's next? Who next are we thankful for?
I know when I was thinking about it, the first character that came to mind is actually from the web show The Guild.
Mm.
It's Codex, the main character, Felicia Day's character. Because I remember being really young and we had gotten, you know, we'd gotten big new fancy Xbox. And I remember my dad was like, hey, let's watch this show. And it was The Guild because it was available on some app, whatever. That part of the story doesn't matter. What matters is I had never seen, like, in the media I had been watching, mm-hmm. I had never seen a nerdy character. Especially not, I don't want to say that, for me it was a positive light, because she was the protagonist. It was all about her. About her and what she went through. And so for me, seeing a nerdy girl who was just, like, going through life, it was just really cool for me. And it was the first thing that, like, I had played video games, so it was the first thing that really showed me that, yeah, girls can play video games, girls can do fun, nerdy stuff, that's totally okay. And something about Felicia Day that still sticks with me today, she's just such an inspiration for me, her and her character and Codex. So I always look back fondly, and I go back and I watch that series all the time, because I remember how much, like, as silly as it sounds now, I didn't really grasp the full concept when I was younger, but I wanted to be like Codex. I wanted to have a guild and play video games all day and go on these wacky shenanigans where I got to hang out with cool video game people, and I thought that was the raddest thing in the world.
How old was the character? What age group?
She's early mid-20s, I think. Okay. And I was pretty young when I started watching The Guild. But along with that, with it being a web show, it mm-hmm. introduced me to a lot of web media, which is what I'm primarily interested in now. I watch almost exclusively web series now. Series? Is that a word?
It is now.
So, for me, I just remember seeing that first bit of the episode where she's sitting there and she goes, oh, it's Friday night, still jobless, yay. And hearing, like, the opening theme of that song, and it just reminds me of what got me into all of this. And I'm so thankful for that, because if I hadn't started watching that dumb TV show, then odds are I would not be anything like I am right now.
Well, right. And that's another series that she had a great character arc, a story arc. Heather, I'm assuming you haven't seen it by
no.
your questions. No, I'm also a big fan of The Guild, and a big fan of Felicia Day. And, you know, she starts out as, you know, your very stereotypical introvert, nerdy. She only interacts with people via webcam. And by the end of it, she's gone out. She's, you know, gotten herself a job. She's, you know, gotten herself, you know, relationships that are outside of that video. And nothing that, you know, not that there's anything wrong with myself being an introvert myself. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But it very much, she grows as a character and very much becomes a woman versus, you know, almost a girl character. You know, you have the man-child trope. She's very much the female version of that when the show starts. And by the end of it, she's, you know, a fully fleshed character that has her own ambition, you know, that is willing to turn off that webcam and get away from it. Whereas, you know, she's almost addicted to it in the first couple of episodes.
Not almost. She is. The first scene is her therapist breaking up with her. She's addicted.
And you said this is what kind of really got you into web series.
Yes, absolutely. It's because, you know, I would go on YouTube and I would look for the videos and I'd be like, wow, this is so cool. And then that's how I started watching Rooster Teeth, which is another company other than, you know, now that since the guild, Felicia Day, has moved on and made Geek and Sundry, I also started watching Rooster Teeth, which completely changed my life. Honestly, if it hadn't started with the guild, I'd probably be like, I don't know, playing volleyball right now or something.
Is this where I make a red versus blue joke?
Please do. I will enjoy it.
Time is not a line. Time is a circle. Because of clocks.
Exactly. Caboose knows.
God bless Caboose.
Oh, true. So true. Yeah, it's just, it's really interesting to me how, just when I think how different it would have gone had I not been shown that. I still, like, now that I understand the show better, I still hesitate to say positive light, because it's pretty clear at the beginning of the series she's kind of pathetic. But for me, it was, she was the coolest thing. She was like a superstar. So for me to see that totally changed my outlook on how, what it was like to be, you know, a stereotypical nerd or a geek or whatever. And to me, it made it okay.
Well, and at the same time, she wasn't, though. I mean, if you look back at some of the movies from the 80s, the few times, like Real Genius, where you had the stereotypical geek, the stereotypical female geek was, you know, glasses, she didn't wear makeup, she had her hair all over the place. Very, very much the negative stereotype, and with it being played by, you know, Felicia Day. Which, you know, there's probably no way she can look bad.
True.
And so it was very much a much more positive portrayal of what a female geek, well, and geeks overall, can be. It's very much following on the latest trend of it's chic to be geek.
Right.
That's one of the songs in the later seasons. I'm the One That's Cool. It was all about, maybe in high school I was a nerd, but now I'm cooler than you, so.
I think it's interesting that you brought up that we did have that physical trope of the geek girl, of course, had to, you know, like the no makeup and the glasses and the, you know, that there was this physical thing that we had before that, and now it's morphed where the geek girl doesn't have to be that. She could be, you know, anything from this bombshell to, you know, other end of the spectrum. You can be anywhere in there that you can still be a geek, and you need those. I think you need some of those characters to start breaking those boundaries and grow out of those stereotypes that we have so ingrained in society.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. It was really important for me to see as a kid, especially since, like I said, I was a kid. So a lot of that media, all the nerds were like that. They were, oh yeah, I love Digimon, or, you know, or whatever. It was
Urkel types.
So negative, and I did not want to be that. I didn't want to be that in school, because I was in elementary school, and that's the worst thing to be. I don't want to be bullied on the playground, like all these other nerds in the kid shows I watched. So it really made me more comfortable and less scared to be who I was.
Sci-Fi for Chicks will be right back.
Hi, this is Jason Hutt, editor-in-chief at scififorme.com, taking a moment to say thank you for listening to this podcast and to invite you to listen to our other podcasts. We have opinions on a lot of things, and we hope you join us both in listening to our thoughts and sharing your own. You can find it all by going to scififorme.com and clicking the podcast tab. Books, movies, TV, conventions, video games, comic books, the latest news, all in one place. scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Kind of relating to my child, one of the characters that I've mentioned before, and I've even mentioned before in this podcast so far, but for me, someone that was really important was the original Bionic Woman. Let's not even talk about the new one. Lindsay Wagner. That was one of my favorite shows as a small child. And we'll pretend I'm much younger than I am. So I was very, 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 very small when I watched that. But the fact that I identified with her so much. I love this character. I was the Bionic Woman for 3 Halloweens running. Because first off, it was a very warm costume, you know, just jogging pants and the top. And I just put a little thing on the jacket that said the Bionic Woman. You just run real slow and go, yeah, had the fun there while all my friends are in these pretty little princess things, freezing their butts off. But it wasn't until I saw Lindsay Wagner and I asked her about getting more strong female characters as leads that she kind of embodied what I think I knew all along, that what she tried to do with the Bionic Woman was not just be a man in girls' clothing, that wasn't what a strong female character was, being able to kick butt the way the guys can and do everything, that she was very focused on trying to be a woman, do things the way a woman would do, look, get in touch with her feminine side, and that feminine did not mean weak. It didn't equate that way to her, and that she was trying to find different ways to use her bionic powers. You know, sometimes that she said that they had to have like so many bionic episodes, incidences per episode. Like, I think it was 3. She said they had to show off the bionics. She was like, can't I just be like trying to open a jar of something and I go a little bit crazy? Can't it be to do something totally different instead of kicking the bad guys, you know, and doing something with the bad guys? She was trying to find different ways to be a strong female, not just strong and kick butt. Something that in the pre-show Angie did bring up, sometimes that's just how the character is supposed to be, like Black Widow. But I think it's much more interesting if we don't fall into the stereotype that a strong woman has to be able to just kick butt in tighter pants and high heels.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why I enjoyed Peggy Carter as much as I did, because she fought like a girl, quote unquote.
Exactly.
Her fighting style was very feminine in terms of how she threw a punch, how she, you know, kicked and whatnot. And that was okay.
Exactly.
Not to interrupt too much, but I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with the show Ruby. The main team is all females, and 2 of them, quote, wear combat skirts. And it's all about how, like, there was someone who criticized them on how they didn't make sense. But they're combat skirts, and it's Weiss and Ruby, and they're going to kick butt with a giant scythe and an awesome fencing sword all they want. Even if it's in a skirt, and in Weiss's case, like, giant heels.
No, I have not.
I haven't seen that one. I've heard of it, though. I think actually talking with you and AJ one time, maybe.
But it reminds me of the ongoing debate about poor Bryce Howard in heels in Jurassic World, which I have not seen yet, so.
Going back to, we talked about this in the Women of Jurassic Park, something that she said that makes total sense to me, if she was wearing, like, athletic shoes or hiking boots, it wouldn't make sense for her character because her character was corporate. And so she was just following through with what would have happened with her character. Her character's not going to stop and change clothes when she's thinking about trying to rescue her nephews. So it did make sense to me.
But I am thinking of the scene in Romancing the Stone where he takes her heels and cuts off the heel.
I did think she should have done that. That would have been good. I did think of that exact same scene. But I thought it was interesting that that became such a big deal.
Well, have you ever tried running in heels? It's not fun.
No, some women, though, can do it. I can't even stand in heels, much less walk or run.
It's not fun, but it's not impossible. I've seen it done.
I know women that they wear heels all the time, and actually putting on something more flat is very uncomfortable for them, and they wouldn't be able to run that way. So God bless them. I can't even stand. I'll put them on and go, oh, yes, that looks pretty. Ow. And I haven't even moved my foot, so I'm definitely a Skechers gal myself. Okay, who else are we thankful for? Anyone else?
Well, I mean, I made a whole list. I mean,
go for it.
We haven't even barely touched it. I mean, we can just go on and on. We could probably have an hours-long podcast with that. But the main one, I mean, just like I said, Peggy Carter and some of the newer ones we could talk about. Like I said, I'm very thankful that she's on the scene. And even though still haven't seen the second episode, Supergirl, I'm really enjoying her character as well as the character of Calista Flockhart. Especially since it's such an obvious homage / parody of Ally McBeal.
Which is classic in and of itself.
But Well, and the fact that her parents were Helen Hunt and Dean Cain. I squeed at that. because I am one of those rare people that actually liked the Helen Hunt Supergirl movie. I remember seeing it at a slumber party way back when. I thought it was cute. I haven't seen it since, just because, you know, one of these days I'll invent the 48-hour times. But yeah,
it's probably best not to, and just have that back memory of it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we can talk about some of the stuff that are coming back, like, you know, the X-Files with Dana Scully. She was very much a character that you didn't see very often in the 90s, because she was, again, one of those that was not just, definitely not a romance, because they definitely, Chris Carter was all about not plugging the chemistry between the two of them, and was very much, her job came first, and then her relationships came second, which is not, you know, when you did see it back then, it was very much the stereotypical spinster character. Right. And it was very rarely seen in a positive light back then, and that was a very positive portrayal of her.
Also, I don't know how much we want to get into this, but maybe some of the ladies in genre media, or in science that we really like, we could talk about that as well, because I have one or two names in media.
Oh, please do.
The two I originally had on my list was, like I said, Codex, and then... Actually, I thought it was funny when you brought up Fiery Redheads, because both of my main ones are. My other one was Meg Turney. She's a cosplayer, and she runs Free Play for Rooster Teeth, and she's a model, and she's also a huge, huge geek. In fact, this is one of my favorite things about her. Just recently, she did a shoot with Playboy, but the next day, she was working on her set, talking about stupid internet videos and playing video games with, and talking about video games and stuff like that. And I think that's the coolest thing, because she is absolutely gorgeous. I don't know if you've ever met her or seen her, but that's another thing where it was like, I don't want to, this sounds really bad, but seeing like a pretty nerd girl, like really like inspired confidence in me that I'm not always going to be seen as negative in like the way I look just because of what I like. And she's also, other than being a model, being a cosplayer, she's a really supportive cosplayer. She's so nice to talk to, and she's really talented, and she really inspires my work. I got to meet her 2 years ago. I get all of my cons messed up. I think it was 2 years ago at Planet Comic Con. And she gave me like a cupcake and was just the sweetest thing in the entire world. And I left talking with her so warmed, and I think that's really important to have when you get to meet someone, is that, like, when you get finished talking to them, especially at a con where things are kind of rushed and busy, you don't feel like, oh, I just got sent out of there. You leave feeling like, oh, wow, that person was really nice, and they were so nice to me, and, oh, they're my favorite person, and yay. And she's really good at inspiring that feeling, and I could just go on about Meg for hours because I'm a nerd.
That's really important, though, that you're saying, because when you meet these people, whether it's an actor that portrays a character you love, or somebody who's a creator, an author or such of something that you love, or someone that you just admire, you know, you first see her, Meg, up somewhere over here, and you don't have that interaction. If you meet them and then they're total jerks, it can just ruin the rest of it for you. And so it's really important when you do make that connection and you feel like you have that special connection and that you feel that this person is true and genuine. I think it adds a nice aspect to the rest of the work that they do, whether it's fiction or nonfiction.
Well, and one of the people that Cammy had brought up in her email, she couldn't be here, speaking of people behind the scenes, Majel Barrett. I mean, not only was she on Star Trek and the voice of the computer, but she was a huge, huge influence in every iteration, and very much, you know, was very much constantly fighting for female representation on the bridge and along with her, you know, Nichelle Nichols, whatnot. But she was very much the silent voice that you never very, you know, she fought the good fight in terms of women on TV and women behind the camera as well.
She was really great. I had the pleasure of working with her on an episode of Deep Space Nine. And again, this is one of those, I met her and she was more than I was expecting, and in a good way. She was so gracious, and so she had this inner, I want another word besides strong. She had this inner strength that she just exuded, this confidence that was also so open and welcoming. And I think you see that in all the different characters she portrays, even if she's somebody that's a little more brash like Luoxana, or if she's number one where she's trying to be almost Vulcanish but not really, or the computer or Nurse Chapel or anything else. When she was alive and advocating for the Star Trek legacy or space or anything like that, she was definitely a force to be reckoned with, and she's definitely left a strong imprint. Speaking kind of in that same vein, someone that I was really also happy to see was Andrian, who was Carl Sagan's wife, but she also helped bring both cosmoses to the screen. And I think it's really important that we have something like that, that is this more popular science view that gets people interested, because we're starting to fall behind in science with the rest of the world. And that's bad. That's very bad, because science is part of, even, you know, now it's not just STEM now. There's also STEAM, because they're adding the arts,
thankfully,
into that, because they realize that that is a part of it, and that science affects art and art affects science. I like that she was really trying to get this out there, that, you know, helping with bring Cosmos back, both for Carl's legacy, but also because it is so important to our generations, not just one generation, but generations, to have this connection and bring it to where it's not just, ooh, the scientists know all this fancy stuff and I don't need to know that. She really wanted to make that connection. She was also in charge of the music selections that were on Voyager 1 and 2, that are on Voyager 1 and 2. So she helped pick the music that might be the first thing that another life form could hear from us when they find Voyager. So when the Borg come back all singing songs to us, it'll be because of her.
Well, and back to the behind the scenes, you made me think of Jane Espenson. I mean, huge genre influence. I mean, wrote a lot of Buffy, Angel. She even wrote some of Torchwood. I would love to see Moffat tap her for Doctor Who.
I would love for Moffat to, yeah, no, definitely. I would love to see, yeah.
Yeah,
sorry. The Moffat stuff is, that's another podcast. We're doing Moffat ranting.
I know.
But I'm just saying, and I'm sure there's a good reason she hasn't been, but we'll go into that later. But no, she definitely knows how to write genre and knows how to write women in genre very, very well. I mean, and every time, I mean, that's one of the reasons I stayed as long as I did on Once Upon a Time, and I finally just, it didn't work for me, but the main reason I started watching it was because she was the showrunner.
Right.
And I was like, well, I've always liked everything she's done before. Didn't she write several episodes of Warehouse 13 too?
I think so.
Which, I mean, I love everything but the last season of that show. Don't get me started on the last season of that show. Well, mainly for one vital reason. That was one of the few shows I could shout out that you had a male and a female co-stars that didn't have a romantic interest.
Oh, yeah.
And they ended up getting together in the last season. I'm like, no, leave them as friends. Come on. Yeah.
It's so much more powerful, I think. Mm-hmm. Not every relationship has to end up with romantic, sexual, because it's man-woman.
Exactly. I mean, that's part of the reason I, as I'm sure will come as no surprise to you, I'm a huge slasher. And one of the reasons I like Slash is because it's, you know, it says, you know, well, if you had a man and a woman in the same dynamic, people would be constantly talking about, why aren't they together yet? You know, why is the fact that they're both the same sex or same gender, you know, stopping this?
Right. I think it's interesting you brought up Once Upon a Time, because that's one I still watch, but that's mainly because, you know, Hook is hot. So I admit it, that the last season and a half is totally just so I can watch a hot guy be hot. And I started watching it because it did have those female characters at the center and the core. And I don't know if they're going to be able to unjump the shark that they did quite a while back on that one. But again, that's another episode. Another episode entirely.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Marie's going, yeah, when are we having that venting, ranting podcast?
Well, and I don't know if either of you follow Black Girl Nerds on Twitter.
Mm-mm.
They're obviously, you know, African-American women nerds, and they're constantly talking about how the black women nerds are portrayed vastly different than white women nerds on TV. You get much more of the Urkel when you get the African-American portrayal, whereas the white women typically are, you know, much less that, and usually are involved in some sort of makeover, whereas the black characters don't even get that chance.
Interesting.
That's something I was looking through my list and I'm like, not a single one of these are someone of color. They're all white women for the most part. Although I did mention Ghost in the Shell in my list.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Nichelle Nichols, she talk about groundbreaking, you know, that was such an important role, I think, to have on there. And what I love is if you hear her talk, she didn't realize at the time how important it was that Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. actually had to come to her and say, no, you can't leave. This is important. You are braving this way. You are making this light for future generations. And I think that's fascinating that they can be so in the middle of it. And you're in your little world of my character's not doing as much as I would like. I can move on, and not realizing what the broader scope is. That's something that can equate to the characters as well, that as a character, they get so in their little world that you don't see the effect on the greater story as a whole.
And I also think that situation was something I see a lot on Tumblr, is that, you know, Nichelle is expecting to make a huge leap, whereas Martin Luther King Jr. was very much aware that you kind of sometimes need to make baby steps.
Yeah.
That you can't have, bam, you suddenly have representation. That it has to be slow and very, very subtle at sometimes, mm-hmm. unfortunately, for better, you know, for better, for worse. And that, you know, sometimes the battle has to be a slow, very patient battle. And that's one of the things I keep seeing in some of, you know, that's why a lot of these female characters don't bother me when they are stereotypes, because it's like, you know, it's baby steps. It's baby steps.
Yeah, I can definitely see where you're going with that. You have those baby steps with a small leap, like having the first interracial kiss on TV, that thankfully now is not shocking anymore. It was shocking back then. And I can even see the way they edited that scene, that they were building it for that super shock value. It was a step. Small steps, hopefully, we'll keep it here. Who else? I know we've got tons. We can be thankful for it. We can go on and on. I'm sure we'll do more episodes. We have other holidays. We have Valentine's characters that we love. We have Mother's Day.
If we want to go animated, we could talk about the Powerpuff Girls.
There you go.
Ooh, yes.
I think you hit a winner there with that one, Angie.
Marie, you want to talk about the Powerpuff Girls?
I will, yeah. I really liked the Powerpuff Girls as a kid. They were really cool. I think I was a little younger, but because my sister watched them so much, I watched them with her. I remember being younger and thinking, man, I'm just like Bubbles, and now when I watch it, and then I also remember getting a little bit older and thinking, I'm definitely Buttercup, and now when I watch it, I'm like, yes, I'm Blossom. I love it. And, oh, man, those characters, first of all, I love that it's a cartoon. They're so cute, and I love the animation, and I love that it's just, I just love Powerpuff Girls. Oh. But I like the way it's kind of divided, honestly. I like that it's Sugar Spice and everything nice. I'm kind of at a loss at what to say here. I'm definitely thankful for having, like, female superheroes, especially, I mean, there were preschoolers in canon. They didn't typically act like it, but they were preschoolers in canon, or kindergartners or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so cool as a little kid, that these little superheroes that go and fight Mojo Jojo. And I think that's a really cool thing to have for kids, is to have little girl superheroes, because there's lots of, like, superhero shows that are geared towards guys, all these Marvel shows that are geared towards little boys, but Powerpuff Girls, I hate putting genders on shows, but it was definitely geared more towards girls. I think that's really cool, and I think it's, they also mentioning that nothing about them, their femininity was taken away. They were still little girls, and they wore cute little dresses, and, you know, Blossom and her bow, and Bubbles was always just the cutest little girl, and they didn't take that away for them to be able to kick butt when they're fighting Mojo Jojo. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was nice to see them be, you know, as a little girl, I think you need to have it where the lead of the story can be the girl too. It's not just the only kick-ass girls are the ones that are the sidekicks of the boy superhero, the boy brash, adventurous guy. That's why, again, when I was in kids' books, Dora the Explorer was such a big one, because this is Dora going on her adventures, and there was a huge backlash when they were going to make Dora grow up and be, you know, she was going to become a tween, and suddenly she was going to become basically all about makeup and clothes and all that kind of stuff. And people were saying, but she's Dora the Explorer. She's supposed to still do, just because she's getting older doesn't mean she's not interested in that anymore. And she's only interested in the stereotype stuff. You can still be pretty and want to go out on an adventure. So that's the Powerpuff Girls. I don't remember ever really changing from that.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of that ad for the STEM, where it's they're telling the little girl, you know, you don't want to get dirty and you don't want to do this. And as they watch her as she grows up. Are you familiar with this ad?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah. You know, she gets to the teen and she, of course, is totally not interested in science because she's constantly told not to be dirty and not to break things. And Dora definitely was, you know, all about getting dirty.
Very much so.
Because science is dirty.
As it should be. It should be. If staying in animation, I'll say that the part of a change that I think became for the good, you were talking about the bad years of Disney. That changed with Little Mermaid.
Yes.
And Ariel. And I love Disney. I grew up on Disney, Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and all that. And just love that. I watched all those again after seeing Little Mermaid. And wow. Yeah. The guy really does come and rescue you pretty much all the time. And this is one where she actually went out and rescued him too. They fought as a team in the end. It wasn't just about being the princess and the guy comes to you. And I think that's something that changed it for animation from then on, that it was viable to have the female lead. Beauty and the Beast would not have been what it was if Ariel hadn't opened the way to make it okay for the girl to be her own hero.
Mm-hmm.
If we keep talking about animation, there's possibly infinite amount of good role models in Steven Universe.
Mm.
I don't know if either of you guys are familiar with it, but it's a super cute cartoon show on Cartoon Network right now. And it's about this kid Steven and the Crystal Gems, who are all these female-coded aliens from another world that kick butt and save the Earth, and I guess some of the gems do attack the Earth, but they're still super kick-butt and strong, and it's super cool, and it's really cool for me to have those role models. I know that I have some of the Crystal Gems, Garnet especially. I get so excited when she's on screen because she's just such a role model for me, and she's so cool, and I just get so hyped up. Because it's like, yes, time for Garnet. She's gonna kick butt, or she's gonna say something funny. And it's cool to have those role models, especially since also the Crystal Gems are very motherly. At least Pearl and Garnet both are. And that's really good for kids to see, is to have these kind of motherly, positive role models. Even if they do have it, it's still really cool to have that in such like a cool sci-fi kick butt form.
I like that you brought that up. Back in our Women of Jurassic Park podcast, Jennifer brought up the fact that she liked seeing that motherly, strong motherly aspect to several of the characters. There's quite a few that we didn't like. We won't go into that. You can go back and listen to that podcast. But that you can still have that motherly aspect to you, and it doesn't make you weak. It doesn't make you less strong, less important. It kind of reminds me of a very, this is one huge female character that if you ignore a couple of the movies, Ellen Ripley from the Alien series. First off, groundbreaking that she was the lead really in Alien. But when you have aliens with her protecting Newt and battling the mother alien there, that is a huge, huge breakthrough in science fiction. When it comes to how the woman and the motherly side of women can be portrayed in this.
Yeah, I mean, when you get into the fact that, you know, they say that Ripley was originally written as a man, and when they then ended up casting Sigourney Weaver, they didn't do anything other than change the gender, or change the pronouns.
Right.
And that says so much because, yeah, I mean, I've gone off about how women characters should be more than just men you know, women doing everything men, but this was really the first time that was ever happening, and so that was groundbreaking in and of itself that you had a woman kicking ass and taking names.
Exactly. And wasn't waiting for the guy. I mean, if she was waiting for the guy, it was because it was part of the whole plan that the guy character was going to go do this. And once you do that, I can now execute my part of the plan. It wasn't, I need you to figure out how to do this. I need you to tell me what to do. That was one. I took a science fiction film class, and that was our big one there. Unfortunately, it was really one of the only ones at that time that we could talk about when it came to women leads in science fiction. But luckily, that was quite a long time ago. So things have definitely changed since then. Okay, let's do a couple final ones, and we can always talk more on a future one, but don't want to go on too long. So let's do a final thankful for.
I can pull up one. We talked a little bit about Red versus Blue earlier. Mm-hmm. I really like the character Carolina, Agent Carolina from Red versus Blue.
What, not Sheila?
Okay, Sheila's cool too. But for me, I adore Carolina. I've adored her since the beginning of the Freelancer Chronicles. I really like that she's such, like, a conflicted character, because they talk about how, like, when Tex is introduced, and there's a factoid that Price gives later in seasons, it's in, like, season 12 or so, and he talks about how Carolina is, like, 12 point whatever statistic he gave more likely to neglect her teammates when faced with a challenge, and she's not a perfect character at all, and she very well could be, because the show isn't really about her, it's about the Reds and Blues, but they took the time to make her this flawed character, but she's still so strong and driven, and she has such a sad backstory, but she still powers through. And I like too how she, you know, when all of the freelancers, even when Wash started working with the Reds and Blues, they were all kind of like, ugh, these dummies, and now it's progressed to the point where they're super good friends. I feel like she's just had such good character development from when she was first introduced till now, and she's such a powerful character. And, there's not really anything I can think about that I don't like about Agent Carolina. I also like that, obviously, they're all covered in armor in the show, and so there's nothing sexualized about her. There's one point during the Freelancer Chronicles when she takes off her helmet, but she's not overly done up. There's nothing to sexualize about her character. She is strong, she is powerful, and if you even tried something on her, she would probably punch you into the next planet. So mm-hmm. I really, really like Carolina.
That's one worth checking out.
That definitely leads into the one I was thinking. My husband would kill me if we went this entire podcast and I not mention Commander Susan Ivanova from Babylon 5. The most kick-ass woman of that series. Straczynski being Straczynski, she of course had epic Shakespearean soliloquies / monologues that she gave constantly, but the one that she gave when she was up against the Vorlons, it's like, I am Susan Ivanova, God sent me. But she's another one like that, you know, was very much had to be very kick-ass because she was in the military, but she also had this very vulnerable side, very much, they really played up her personal life, especially as the series progressed, and you know, again, had, they had hinted that she had a lesbian relationship with Dahlia, or at least wanted to. And this was back before you even talked about that on television, let alone mm-hmm. saw it. and so just to have that she was very vulnerable and she had this, you know, inner struggle with her dead brother and all that. And had the series gone as the way Straczynski had intended and she not left the show, it would have been some interesting, I would have loved to see where her character would have gone.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things you always have to be, when it comes to something like a TV show where, yeah, you have actors that do different things or writers that take it in a certain path or, you know, where it changes and yeah, where could it have gone? That happened on several of the shows that I followed, like Lost, where, gee, if the actor just hadn't decided that he hated living in Hawaii, which I don't understand that one bit, where could this character have gone and what else could there have been? Or if this person hadn't gotten sick or, you know, it hadn't tested a certain way. Yeah, that's a good one. I have to admit, I kind of totally forgot about Babylon 5. Sorry.
Well, it's kind of, that show overall is kind of forgotten a lot of times just because it was done at a time when sci-fi shows weren't really done. It also was not on one of the major networks, and it's very much a cult TV show even today's standards. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they keep talking about possibly renewal, but it's hard when like half your cast is dead. I mean, not to imbibe this with dark humor, but you know, unfortunately, with the guy who played Franklin and the guy who played Jakar, both passed. And those were like, Jakar especially was like the most, you know, one of the most powerful characters on that show. Mm-hmm. And so to, you know, a reboot might be better than a continuation just because, but then again, I'm not a big fan of reboots. Right. They work occasionally, but you know.
I would say I'd probably have to end with another childhood one, but one that still continues today because thank goodness we have a new Star Wars movie coming out in December.
Yay.
That I am really hopeful and positive for because I love you, George, but so glad you're not at the helm of it anymore. Princess Leia for me, and we're going to talk more about her in an upcoming episode because we actually want to talk about the women of Star Wars. So we're going to talk about Princess Leia and Padme. I want to compare and contrast the mother-daughter there. But I think this was mid-70s, you know, 70, 77 when this came out. And to see a woman like her be able to still be, again, very feminine. She looked very, I love the dress at the end. She's running around in, you know, this white dress with the buns on her head. But to not wait for the guys, to not cower under pressure, to have plans and to be moving forward with things. I think she was a really great role model for us as kids back then and continues to be. I think Leia is just a really important character, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they're doing with her, going to do with her in this next trilogy and how she's going to be treated, because again, we'll talk about that in the Star Wars episode, but comparing her to what they did with Padme, I think it's very important to see where they're going to take her. But she was a very pivotal for me as a child, and very thankful that she kind of came into the sci-fi world.
Yes, definitely a strong influence on me as well, because, you know, I think I remember seeing Empire Strikes Back in a drive-in theater. Yeah, with my dad, who took us all there. And even, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of issues with the slave Leia, which I'm sure you'll get into in the next podcast and all that. But even then, the fact that she used her sexuality as a weapon, mm-hmm. Was very much a, you know, I see it as a positive thing. It's kind of like the Charlie's Angels kind of thing, where it's, yeah, you know, they take in the fact that men, heterosexual men, are distracted by the sexy and used it for good.
Definitely. Hey, so Marie, with you being so much younger, what is your take on Leia? I mean, I grew up with Leia when she first came out. You know, Star Wars was out when you came
around.
Well,
here's an interesting thing. My parents were both really big Star Wars fans, so they showed it to me and my sister when I was very young. But they showed it to me in chronological order rather than the order that the movies came out.
I'm sorry.
So I was introduced to Padme first, and I was also very young, so I never really, you know, I wasn't thinking about it from like a, oh, this is a strong woman point of view. But I do remember watching the first prequel and finding out that it was the queen that went with them. It wasn't actually the hand lady. And I remember thinking, she is so cool. She is just the coolest, and she's so smart. She has a secret decoy. That's so cool. And I just thought that was super duper rad. And I remember loving the part where she sits down and she goes, well, I don't approve. And it's like, they don't know, but we know. And so I remember thinking about that as a little kid. Another thing, and this might be a kind of weird thing for me to have retained from watching the later movies, the first movies that actually came out, is the actress who played Leia. I remember her talking about the blasters and comparing them to hair dryers. And I remember after that always using my hair dryer as a blaster. And I don't know why I thought that was, I don't know how that, for me that was really cool because it gave me a way to identify with that character, and, you know, I could run around and pretend I was her with my hairdryer blaster.
There you go.
And I thought that was really cool. It's been a long time since I've sat down and, like, watched Star Wars, which I probably should since there's, like, a month to go. But, I really liked Padme and Leia both. I thought they were really cool. I remember being distraught at the, isn't it, the end of the third movie. That was, because, like I said, I was really young. In fact, that was one of the first times I'd been introduced to characters dying in movies. So I was like, oh, this can't be happening. It was really awful for me.
Oh.
That was a cruel reality I had to face as a child.
Oh, there are many more to come, Marie. There's more to come. Many more. She keeps saying when she was really young, and I'm like, Marie? Marie, you are young.
There is a big change, though, between, like, being, you know, 10 and being, I'm 16, almost 17. I'm 17 next month. There's a lot of brain development that happens between then that completely changes the way you look at things.
That's very true. And this is where Angie and I will just kind of smile and pat you on the head.
No, this is where I talk about those kids on my lawn. And
there you go.
And that that my marriage is older than you are.
But I love your fresh view, Maria.
No, I'm not.
We love you.
No. I'm very much a fan that growing up, I was always very much pissed that people were always like, you're too young for this. Like, no, I'm not. I know what I'm doing. So it's like, I refuse to fall into that trap myself.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for joining me for this special Thanksgiving episode. Some of the women, I know Angie's list is longer. We have a whole list here from Cammie who couldn't make it. I know Alex, like the back of my hand. I know she has a really long list. We're going to do this again. We'll throw in some more. We've got other holidays coming up, and we've got more episodes. Like I said, we're going to do the Women of Star Wars, because I definitely want to talk about Padme and Leia as we get ready for The Force Awakens. So looking forward to that. Also going to be looking at the women of Harry Potter, but I'm actually not going to start with Hermione. Ooh. I want to start with Bonnie Wright, who played Ginny Weasley, Luna Lovegood, and maybe Cho, because we had Bonnie Wright was at our Dallas Comic Con as well. So we have that video up there on sci-fi4me.com. Would love to really hear what other women of genre everybody would like to talk about. I've been taking notes while Marie and Angie have been talking. It's like, oh, okay, we're going to do that one. Okay, we'll do that one. And we'll get both of you back, because this has been a lot of fun having you both on, and look forward to having you on more.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to us. Remember, you can find us on iTunes at Sci-Fi for Chicks, and you can follow us on Twitter. And if you want to join us on one of these and talk about some of your favorite female characters, well, good and bad, we want to talk about the good and bad side, please let us know. Again, that hotline number is 573-427-2434. 573-42-SCI-FI. And you can find us, of course, over on sci-fi4me.com. Marie has been doing a lot of conventions. I'm sure you're getting geared up for something else, right?
My next convention isn't till at least February, but work has started for the two big ones, Planet and NACA, coming up. So
Planet Comic Con.
I've got a pile of fabric for those two staring me in the eye right now, and I'm like, oh, I'll get to you.
And Andrew, what do you have coming up? What do you want to let everybody know? Check out with you.
I am, once I'm done with this, I get to write an article that I'm writing for Den of Geek. And I just had a piece for the Mary Sue. But right now I'm just working with, I just now found a new job. Marie, you'll be impressed to know that my CEO is Aaron DeVoice, who is the former CEO of Machinima.
Oh, that's cool.
But, and my whole point is to basically research YouTube owners, and so I watch a lot of YouTube during the day, which is as odd as you think. But in terms of coming up, in terms of genre, just a lot of writing. I'm trying to get more writing done for Sci-Fi for Me. I know that there's a big, kind of genre, but not. Just bought tickets for the Sherlock special, mm-hmm. and planning on getting together with a bunch of SoCal Sherlock fans for that. But there's a big nerd thing going on New Year's Eve that I'm contemplating whether I want to go, because I'm not big on going to things because I'm an introvert. Rich and I just went to the BlizzCon pre-party on Thursday night because he's doing the virtual ticket for it. So it's been interesting hearing some of he plays a lot more than I do, mainly because we only have the one account. And so it's been interesting hearing his feedback from that. The party itself was, I'm contemplating writing a review of it, but it's not going to be very positive. So
sometimes those can be fun.
Yes. No, it was more than one person joked that it was Line Con because it was a lot of standing in lines.
Yeah, they need to. That's where the conventions really need to take a cue from Disney because they know how to do a queue. Not exactly. In the old days, but now they do. Oh, do they? And yeah, I've had a lot of comments on that one myself. We will see you next time. Like I said, keep an eye out for that next Women of Genre where we talk about Padme and Leia and so many more coming down the pipeline. Thank you again for listening to us. We'll catch you next time on sci-fiforme.com, sci-fi for chicks. On our next episode, the ladies talk the women of Doctor Who, the Russell T. Davis years.
I do not like the Martha hate that's out there just because, yeah, she fell for him.
In fact, she met guys who fell in love with her.
I don't understand a doctor becoming romantically involved with a companion because to me, they're not supposed to.
I was sitting there watching the episode and I was like, oh my God, she's going to do it. She can't, but she's going to do it. And I was so into it and I was so emotional and she got me there.
What I think I love is that she really doesn't think much of herself, but she does. But if you say that to her, she's going to come back and fight.
When I first met her as a character on the show, I wasn't sure whether I would like her or not. She grew on me very quickly.
That's next time on Sci-Fi for Chicks, Women of Genre.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi For Me Radio.